To this experienced group of litigating lawyers, ladies and gentlemen, I need hardly urge the importance of expert witnesses. With ever-increasing frequency, litigation of all sorts, state and federal, civil and criminal, protracted and not so protracted, will turn upon a lawyer's skill at presenting to judge or jury the testimony of an expert, or in due course, attacking the testimony of an expert. It's understandable then that a very good portion of the law of evidence deals with expert witnesses, and a very good portion of the craft of advocacy, the technique of the courtroom, deals with experts, and a very important fraction of the law of professional responsibility, as we shall see, deals with expert witnesses. Now, I think it would be of minimal use to you were I simply to stand up here and rehearse the law of evidence, the craft of advocacy, the law of professional responsibility, as those bodies of learning deal with experts. Instead, let me tell you at the outset what I propose to try to do. I am going to raise the 5 or 6 questions that it seems to me must be considered by a lawyer preparing to try a case involving experts and then actually going to the courtroom and trying that case. And finally, I will talk about some ideas I have on how to argue the testimony of an expert to a jury or to a judge. It really makes no difference. And by the way, for shorthand from now on, I shall simply refer to a jury. We understand that in a non-jury trial, you're talking to the judge, but I really don't think that one handles it in any very different manner. I shall do my best to sketch out for you the answers to these 5 or 6 principal questions that you would find had you the virtually unlimited leisure it takes to go to the library and research the literature. And I shall weave together, to the extent that I can, considerations drawn from the law of evidence, from the craft of advocacy, and from the law of professional responsibility. Enough by way of preface, let's go to work. The first question is one that, in my experience, rarely occurs to a lawyer as worth considering. And perhaps that's because, in 99 cases out of 100, the question is not worth considering. But in that one case out of 100 where there's something to be done with this question, shame on you if you overlook the possibility of raising it, arguing it, and who knows, perhaps even prevailing on it. The question can be put in a number of ways. This is as good as any. How do you identify an issue in connection with which it will be proper to call an expert to the stand and have the expert give the jury his opinion? On what kinds of issues may experts testify? Now, I repeat what I just said. Most of the time, it's beyond question that the issue is one on which an expert may testify. But if in one case out of 100, you as the opponent can persuade the judge at the threshold to exclude the other side's offer of expert testimony, you have accomplished something worth accomplishing. Well, let's see how it might work. I give you the facts of a case. 2-lane highway. Traffic moves in opposite directions. It's the middle of the night. From the east, a car approaches. From the west, another car approaches. Each car is driven by a lone driver, no passengers, no bystanders, bang, head-on collision. And when the smoke clears, you've got one car there, another car there, skid marks and debris scattered over the highway, and 2 dead drivers. One estate sues the other estate. Now remember, we have no survivors, no witnesses. The question, of course, is what was the point of impact? Because once you know the point of impact, you can be pretty certain that you know which driver fell asleep at the wheel, and at least on the question of liability, the case is concluded. On that question, what was the point of impact, one side or the other calls an expert, someone whose credentials as a master of traffic analysis, accidentologists as they're beginning to be called, is offered. There is no dispute about the person's credentials. The question is whether this is the kind of issue on which an expert may testify, the point of impact given those facts. Well, at least twice in our legal history, that case has come up. I have given you the facts of the case, not one case, but 2 cases. It came up once before a federal judge in North Dakota. That's the Ian case that's mentioned there in the outline. And the federal judge, under the settled rule in the federal cases, as the rule then stood, said the expert may testify. The identical facts came up in a state case, that Musser case cited from the New York reports. And the state court said, no, the expert may not testify. I repeat, The decision is not based upon the credentials of the expert. That was beyond dispute in both cases. It's a decision at the threshold. Is this an issue on which an expert may testify? The federal judge says yes, the state judge says no, and a keen legal thinker therefore begins to suspect that there are two different rules at work here, and indeed there are. The federal judge, applying the rule that had come to be expressed in a fair number of federal cases, applied what you might think of as a rather undemanding standard, a standard that opens the door wide to the receipt of expert testimony, that is generous to the occasions on which an expert will be allowed to testify. And if you had to just put it into a single word, I guess it would be this. So long as the opinion from this expert will help or assist this jury, the expert may testify. The state judge in that New York case said the expert may not testify, so obviously he is applying a more demanding standard, one that is stringent, that closes the door considerably to those occasions when an expert will be allowed to testify. If you had to put it into a word, I suppose you'd say, in those jurisdictions which follow the New York state case, the expert's opinion is admissible only if it's necessary to the jury. So the generous rule, it need only be helpful to the jury. The ungenerous rule, it must be necessary to the jury. Now, those federal cases which supported or underlay the decision of the judge in the Ian case have been codified. They have been codified in Federal Evidence Rule 702. And you can read it at your leisure, but what it adds up to is exactly what we have said. The expert may testify if his opinion will assist or help the jury. Whether it's a majority or a minority rule is unimportant. A number of states will follow the New York decision and require that the expert's opinion be helpful to the jury before it's admissible. And I dare say that in a large number of states, there is no authority because the question has never been raised. And it's never been raised because lawyers don't realize that in a certain number of cases, it's there to be raised. Obviously, if it is to your client's advantage to exclude the expert's testimony, and assuming that you write on a blank slate, you will be citing the New York case and other cases that you can pick up by shepherdizing the New York case. In a jurisdiction such as the federal court, such as Minnesota, which has enacted the federal rules of evidence substantially, why, of course, the issue is foreclosed as a matter of doctrine, you know the answer. The expert may testify if the expert's opinion will help the jury. Well, that's easy enough, and it gets us started. Let me try to relieve the gloom that seems to afflict most of you by putting a case to you, simply to drive this point home, and then we'll move along. I put the case really for personal reasons, which I will explain after I put the case. And so, if I may have your ears, ladies and gentlemen, each of you is now a federal judge. You have been presiding for some weeks over a celebrated federal criminal case, perhaps the most celebrated federal criminal case of the decade, if not the century. You're about two-thirds of the way through, and insofar as you, the judge, are concerned, everything seems to have gone smoothly. The indictment is a very simple one. It says the defendant did a certain felonious act. To support that charge, the government has called a principal witness who has testified in no uncertain terms that he knows that the defendant did it because he helped him to do it with his own eyes. He saw the defendant do the act charged in the indictment. Now, the prosecution witness was cross-examined for some 3 or 4 days, but adhered to his testimony in every detail. The defendant has already testified, and he forthrightly denies the charge contained in the indictment. He says he did not do it. The prosecution witness is lying. Now, the defendant was also cross-examined for some 3 or 4 days and adhered to his denial of guilt in every jot and tittle. There is corroborating evidence on both sides about equal in weight. It cancels out. And it's perfectly obvious to everyone that when the jury retires to deliberate, their verdict will turn upon how they assess the credibility of that prosecution witness. If they believe him, guilty. If they don't believe him, not guilty. It's as easy as that. You are ready to go on the bench at 10 o'clock. It's now 9:45. You are resting in your robing room, doing whatever federal judges do at 9:45 in the morning. Perhaps you are having your brandy, smoking your big black cigar, whatever, when a knock on the door, and I tell you that when the knock comes on the door, even though you are a federal judge, your heart tends to skip a beat. In they come, defense counsel, prosecutor, and the court reporter. Defense counsel now makes an application to you. Here it is. Judge, it is perfectly clear to everyone that when the jury retires to deliberate in a couple of days or a week or so, their verdict will turn upon their assessment of the credibility of the prosecution witness. Now, Judge, I have out in the courtroom, ready to testify at 10 o'clock when you take the bench, an expert witness, a psychiatrist. But this is no ordinary psychiatrist, Judge. This is the immediate past president of the American Psychiatric Association. This is a professor of medicine at the Cornell Medical School and chief of psychiatry at the New York Hospital. He has just been appointed professor of medicine at the Harvard Medical School and chief of psychiatry at Massachusetts General, positions he will take up next fall. He is probably America's preeminent psychiatrist. Now, this doctor will freely concede that he has never met or clinically examined the prosecution witness, but he has observed him on the witness stand, he has been told the facts of his life, and he has read everything the prosecution witness has ever published, that witness being a professional writer. On the basis of all of that, he has an opinion as to the prosecution witness's mental state. May I put that opinion to the jury? You're the judge. What's your ruling? Now, do not call for your law clerk. There is nothing for your law clerk to tell you that you don't already know. This is a real case, as I will disclose in a few moments. It was tried before there were federal rules of evidence, but the cases which precede the federal rules of evidence are the cases that guided that judge in North Dakota in the head-on collision case. If the opinion will help or assist the jury, it is admissible. Apply that test, if you please, and I'll ask for a show of hands. I'll tell you why in a moment. How many of you would allow the psychiatrist to testify? Hands, please. How many of you would not allow the psychiatrist to testify? Look around, see the result. I tell you, ladies and gentlemen, that every time I discuss expert witnesses, no matter the nature of the audience, judges, lawyers, law students, even lay people, I put that case to the group. And the response, every single time, has been exactly what you just saw. The vast majority say, no, I will not allow the psychiatrist to testify. And with all deference, your honors, I submit that you are permitting your own skepticism about the psychiatrist's testimony to interfere with the clarity of your judgment. It is not for you, your honor, to conclude that the psychiatrist's testimony is a great big crock. Of course it is, but it's for the jury to say that, not for you. It is for you to decide simply that this opinion may help the jury. The judge in the real case said, yep. Oh, the prosecution screamed and yelled and objected, but the judge said, if the test is what it is, if it helps the jury can hear the opinion, I must allow this psychiatrist to testify. And that was the judge's ruling, recognizing that it was as far as any judge had ever had to go applying this rule. The judge wrote a little memorandum so that there would be a permanent memorial of it in the books. To this day, it is as far as any judge has had to go, applying the liberal rule. The judge's name was Henry Goddard. The psychiatrist's name was Carl Binger. The prosecution witness's name was Whitaker Chambers, and the defendant's name was Alger Hiss. The psychiatrist took the stand, and he testified that, in his opinion, Whitaker Chambers was suffering from a defect of personality characterized by a tendency to tell lies and make false accusations. And he was then cross-examined. He was cross-examined by Thomas Murphy, the government prosecutor, one of the best trial lawyers of all time. Many of you know that, in my judgment, cross-examination should be short. I will be making that point emphatically this afternoon. Do you know for how long Thomas Murphy cross-examined Carl Binger? Thomas Murphy cross-examined Carl Binger for 3.5 days. And do you know why Thomas Murphy cross-examined Carl Binger for 3.5 days? Because he was having too much fun to stop. That's why. Right. To this day, I am informed, when the dean of the Harvard Medical School greets the incoming first-year students, he says, I've got 3 things to advise you. First, get a microscope. Second, have an adequate supply of tongue depressors. And third, never go to court. Remember what happened to Dr. Binger. He tried to play the lawyer's ball game in the lawyer's ballpark by the lawyer's rules, and he didn't even know what the rules were. So, of course, he was made to look a fool. Perhaps we'll spend a little bit more time on the cross-examination of Dr. Binger later this morning when we talk about the cross-examination of experts. I spend a few moments, though, on it now, simply because I see some faces in the room that are sufficiently unlined to suggest that for some of you, the scars have yet to be achieved. You haven't been around the merry-go-round that often, and there's a certain trepidation that lawyers feel when undertaking the cross-examination of an accountant, an economist, a doctor, a psychiatrist, some professional in a field foreign to us. Nonsense. The fact is, trial work has very few pleasures to equal that of cross-examining an expert, especially a doctor, and most especially a psychiatrist. You can't always destroy them the way Murphy destroyed Binger, but you can always lay a glove on them. And it's wonderful to do it. So stay with me, and sometime a little bit before lunch, we'll talk about some ways of laying a glove on him. Well, so much for that first question. How do you identify an issue on which an expert may testify? There is what I can tell you on it. And let us move on to what for every practicing lawyer is a question of enormous practical import and difficulty, but almost never discussed, let alone mentioned, by law professors and others who talk about expert witnesses as a phenomenon in the law of evidence. Right, the first question we assume you have resolved affirmatively. Here is an issue in connection with which it will be proper to call an expert. Second question, how do you identify the expert you want to call? Saying the same thing in a different way, how do you find the expert? And as anyone who has the scars, who has been around the merry-go-round a few times knows, you find the expert anywhere you can. Do not neglect the experience of other lawyers in your office. Do not hesitate to talk to your friend in the law office across the corridor. Do not neglect the resource of the bar. I don't mean the bar association, I mean the bar, the place where lawyers drown their sorrows. You know, you talk and you pick up information about who's around and who makes a pretty good expert, etc. Do not neglect what is in fact one of the marvels of our civilization, one of the most interesting artifacts we have produced here as we head into the 21st century. It is the classified telephone book in any large city. Just leaf through it sometimes for sheer amusement. Look at the incredible things people do for a living. And they're all there in the classified telephone book. You need an expert in chicken feathers? You can probably find it under C in the classified telephone book. Chicken feather experts. Call them up and you're in business. If you happen to be fortunate enough to work for government, of course, you have built-in institutional resources. Years and years ago, I was lucky enough to be an assistant United States attorney, which means that one had access to the resources of the FBI laboratory in Washington. Do you know that the FBI has on its staff a full roster of experts in every conceivable field? So that if you happen to need an expert in chicken feathers, and honest to God, I did, when I was in the U.S. Attorney's office. They said, call the FBI laboratory. I called up. And I said, hey, fellas, I need an expert in chicken feathers. He'll be there tomorrow morning, 9 o'clock. And he was, a guy with a PhD from the University of Wisconsin in chicken feathers, for God's sakes. There, he's a special agent of the FBI, and we really kill the other side, obviously. When you've got somebody like that, you can't help but kill the other side. The directories, the commercial services that are now available, to supply experts. They're advertised in the back of the ABA Journal and the like in case you need them. And should you ever have the challenge and really the professional good fortune of dealing with a new scientific or technical device, that is something that hasn't been around for a while and you are the first or one of the first lawyers, for example, to offer neutron activation analysis to the jury. Well, you're not going to find an expert in that by looking in the back of the ABA Journal or even in the classified book. Do not hesitate to leaf through the catalog of any great university. And you turn to the appropriate department, and you may find that there is someone teaching a seminar on the very subject which is involved in your offer of evidence. And you just call them up and you ask, right? That's hardly a discussion, but it's probably as much or more than time will allow us to devote to that second question. You've got your issue, now you have identified your expert, and you come to the third question, which I do want to spend some 10 or 15 minutes on, because there's a lot of fairly new and generally unknown law to talk about here. It's a very practical question with some very troubling legal implications. How do you get the expert to come to court? And rather than discuss it in the abstract, let me give it some concreteness. I always try to refrain from war stories. They just tend to waste time, and principally they amuse the teller. But I give you a real case from my early years at the bar, and let's see what the legal implications are. It was shortly after I left the U.S. Attorney's Office. I was retained by the father of a little boy who lived in an upper-middle-class neighborhood in Bronxville. That's just to the north of the Bronx in the New York City area. This little boy was 9 or 10 years old. It was a morning in April, glorious weather, and he left his house and he went to school. He had been doing it for 3 years uneventfully. He had to go down the block, cross the street, and the school was on the other side of the crossing. According to the little boy, and nobody disputed his testimony, he got to the crossing, waited for the light to be green in his favor, and started across. From his left comes the defendant, driving a 20-ton Buick, about 85 miles an hour, heedless of the school crossing signs, dead drunk at 8:30 in the morning, and he hits the kid. And the kid goes through the air like that and lands about 50 feet away, jumps up and says, "That was fun. Let's do it again." "No, no, no, it's not fun. We've got to take you to the hospital." They take him to the hospital, and you know, children tend to survive these things because they do think it's fun. They don't tense up. They get to the hospital, and the doctor says it is a miracle. He's got some bumps and bruises that'll get better in a week, and only one injury worth talking about. He's got a ruptured spleen. You know, it happens to football players who get tackled the wrong way. He's got a ruptured spleen back here. We've got to remove it because ruptured spleen will not get better. If we remove it, that's it. If we don't remove it, septicemia, and he's going to die. So they say, remove it. And a clever surgeon takes it out in about 4 minutes. It's like an appendectomy. It's out. They stitch him up. 1 month later, he's got a little scar of no cosmetic significance whatsoever. The bumps and bruises are all gone, but he has no spleen. And it will never grow back. The spleen does not regenerate. I represent the little boy. And obviously, liability is going to be conceded. It was. The question was damages. And on that question, what the jury was going to have to decide was the significance of the loss of the spleen to that little boy. First question, is that an issue on which an expert may testify? Oh, you bet your life. That's an issue on which an expert may testify, whatever the standard you choose to apply. All right, I'm a kid just beginning to practice. How do you find an expert on spleens who will support the argument that I want to make to the jury? And you know the argument that I would make to the jury, that any one of you would make to the jury representing that little boy. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, the spleen plays a vital, though as yet not fully identified, role in the body's immunological system. Without a spleen, this little boy has a life expectancy that's a great big question mark. He may die of a common cold tomorrow. What's his case worth? Easily $1 million. And any one of you on the other side of the table would be saying, what is he talking about? Spleen. It's a vestigial organ. It's left over from the days when we were fishes, for God's sakes. That he doesn't have it is too bad, but it doesn't mean anything to him. What's the case worth? $1.74. Call it $2 even, all right? So I'm at $1 million. You're at $2. And somehow the jury has to decide. I went to the library and discovered that Nobel Prizes in medicine had been won on both sides of that issue. And a brief sort of personal parenthesis. What a marvelous system we have. When you've got an issue to be decided, and the Nobel Prize winners cannot agree, to whom do we turn? The 6 or 12 ditch diggers, and ribbon clerks, mail carriers. We say, ladies and gentlemen, the Nobel Prize winners are in disagreement, so you figure it out. And they do a remarkable job of deciding. I have a kind of religious faith in those jurors. Somehow they do it. But that's the difficulty of arguing expert witness testimony to a jury. They are ribbon clerks and mail carriers. So how do you argue? Well, that's for just before lunch. In any event, I went to the catalog of the NYU Medical School. Take it back. Through just the almanac, etc., I discovered that indeed Nobel Prizes had been won on both sides of that question, and the Nobel Prize on my side of it, a Nobel Prize in medicine or physiology to someone whose life's work was urging the point that the spleen plays a vital role in the body's immunological system, that man was, he's now dead, was named Severo Ochoa. And I looked him up in the directories, and he was a professor at the NYU Medical School on the east side of Manhattan in New York City. So I had my issue, And I now had my witness. That is to say, I knew his name. And I was confronted by the third question. How do you get the expert to come to court? Now, just because some of you are not as experienced as others, let's run through the possibilities quickly. All right, you call Dr. Ochoa up. I did. You call him up. Dr. Ochoa, you don't know me. I'm a lawyer. I've got a case to try. You know, will you help, etc.? And he says, as Dr. Ochoa did say, he said, well, that's rather interesting. I have never testified in my life. And it's an I don't want to do it every day, but it's an experience I'd like to have once, and I will come and testify. But of course, he might have said, I've got to pay the butcher, the baker, and the landlord just as you do, and I will need to be compensated. Well, of course, doctor. What do you think is fair compensation for your assistance and your time in court? And he might say $500, just picking a number. And so long as your client had it, you would say, that's eminently fair, doctor, $500 it is, and we have a deal. You have a deal? Yes, of course, you have a deal. And if that's the situation, there's nothing to talk about. But now change it. Suppose Dr. Ochoa were to say, I think $500 is fair, and your response perforce was, well, doctor, that is fair. I can't quarrel with that, but my client just doesn't have it. We don't have the resources to pay your fee. And he would probably say, well, in that case, and now, there's nothing that makes a young lawyer ingenious like necessity. And boy, this is necessity staring you in the face. And so the young lawyer would probably be inclined to say, don't hang up, doctor, don't hang up. Doctor, I don't have the $500, but tell me, are you by any chance a gambling man? Now suppose Dr. Ochoa were to say, well, now that you mention it, I do go to Las Vegas every weekend. Ah, now doctor, I can't be certain that we're going to win this lawsuit, as you can't be certain that a given number will come up when you roll the dice. But with your help, there's an excellent possibility that we're going to win this lawsuit. And if we do win it, doctor, there will be a pot of gold, doctor. And 10% of that pot of gold, doctor, will be yours. And he says, deal. Do you have a deal? Yep. What else do you have? Trouble with the Bar Association. That's what you have. And by your laugh, I'm glad to see that all of you know that you have trouble with the Bar Association. Disciplinary Rule 7109C of the Code of Professional Responsibility expressly forbids the retaining of an expert on a contingency. This is not precatory language. This is not truth, justice, and motherhood. This is an unethical act for a lawyer to retain an expert on a contingency. Maybe digression, but not really. Those of you who are attuned to the ways of constitutional lawyers will at once conceive of an argument. And the argument would go something like this. We in the United States, as opposed to our professional cousins across the water in England, welcome contingent retainers of lawyers. We all know that. It's not only a commonplace, it is permissible, and among many legal thinkers, it is something to be encouraged. People, litigants, must have access to the courts because the courts are a principal institution of government. Without access to the courts, in effect, you are disenfranchised. Well, what about a litigant who has no money? Well, he has one asset, a piece of the action, a portion of the lawsuit that he proposes to bring. In order to assure that litigant access to the courthouse, let him retain counsel with the one thing he has, a portion of the lawsuit. That's a contingent retainer. As I say, forbidden in England, but actually encouraged in the United States because of the importance of people having access to the courthouse. How then can you say that you can retain your lawyer, Mr. Indigent Litigant, on a contingency, but your lawyer, nor you, can retain an expert on a contingency? Does not that work an invidious discrimination against poor people, and is it not therefore invalid under the Equal Protection Clause? That challenge was raised. Some years ago, before a very able federal judge in the Eastern District of New York, that's the person against the Association of the Bar case that you see cited in the materials, the district judge agreed. The district judge declared DR 7109C unconstitutional under the Equal Protection Clause. I have not cited the district judge's opinion to you because it was taken up to the Second Circuit, and as you see, the Second Circuit reversed. The Supreme Court denied certiorari. So far as I know, the constitutional challenge has been raised in no other lawsuit, so that represents the law of the land to the extent that you've got authority. DR 7109C, many people would say, is irrational, but the case tells us that it is constitutional. Well, Does that mean that there's nothing you can do? No, no. There's been a lot of activity, as I said, in this area, and there's more to be said. You will see in the materials a citation to the Shore case in the New York reports. Now, I take it for granted that none of you has any particular interest in New York law, but I think that the Shore case may still be very useful for some of you to know about. Here is what happened in the Shore case and my suggestion as to how it may be useful. The Shore case is an opinion decided by the Intermediate Appellate Court in New York, and because it may have a bearing on what I'm about to say, I tell you that among New York lawyers, that Intermediate Appellate Court carries great weight. It just happens in this generation that its judges are particularly able, and people kind of stand up and salute when the appellate division, as it's called, speaks, perhaps even more so than when the highest court of the state speaks. In the Shore case, the arrangement between lawyer and expert was essentially as follows. The expert was retained on a contingency, but there was an additional condition, and the condition was that the contingent retainer agreement would be submitted to the judge for the judge's approval and change. If the judge thought that the circumstances rendered the contingent agreement unfair either to the client or to the expert. That is to say, the judge could say, even though the contingent agreement is 10%, I think 20% is fair to the expert. Or, it's 10%, but that's too much. I think 2% is fair. Whatever it is, everything was subject to judicial oversight, approval, and alteration in accordance with the circumstances that may have been presented. The Intermediate Appellate Court held that the contingent retainer of the expert, when subject to judicial approval in that manner, was ethical. It was both lawful and ethical. The judicial approval condition took it out of the prescription of DR 7109C. Now, what's the importance of the case? You're not practicing in New York, we will assume. But if one's back is against the wall and your only resort or recourse is to retain an expert on a contingency, I would make it subject to judicial approval in accordance with the Shore case. If then a judge in your state were to say, I don't follow the Shore case, I declare this unlawful under the law of state X, so be it. But you have protected yourself against a charge of professional impropriety. The most that can happen is that the judge says, I will not follow the Shore case as a matter of law. But how can they say that you have been guilty of unethical conduct when what you did is follow a precedent of a leading state, moreover an appellate precedent in a leading state? So it seems to me that the Shore case is worth knowing about for that reason. But that's not the end. To conclude this discussion of how you get the expert to court, I turn to one of the most interesting and potentially most important cases on practice and procedure of the last 20 years. And I've been talking about it ever since it came down, and I have found that audiences of lawyers and judges, even federal judges, are generally unaware of this case, even though it's now 8 years old or so. I say potentially the most significant case of the last 20, 25 years. Let me tell you about the case and then point out why it is potentially so important. It is Kaufman against Edelstein, decided by the Second Circuit. You've got the citation there. Kaufman against Edelstein, ladies and gentlemen, was an offshoot of the government's antitrust suit seeking to break up IBM, the one that was tried in the Southern District of New York before Chief Judge Edelstein for some 7 or 8 years. We all remember reading about it in the newspapers, though we may have had no professional reason to follow it. And I did not misspeak, for those of you unfamiliar with antitrust litigation. That case was tried non-jury for 7 or 8 years. Not pretrial, not depositions. The trial took all those years. And for the life of me, I don't know what they were trying, but they went on and on and on. And finally, after both sides had rested, but before the judge decided it, remember the Reagan administration came in and simply surrendered. They said, we agree that our case has no merit. We withdraw the complaint. It infuriated the judge, but there we were. Just briefly, for those of you who are innocent of the world of antitrust litigation, antitrust cases are rather peculiar. There is almost never any controversy on the overt facts. I mean, obviously, between IBM and the government, there was no controversy over how many computers IBM manufactured and how many they sold and what the revenues were and so forth. Instead, antitrust cases turn entirely upon expert witnesses. The government typically calls one half of the economics professors of the United States, each and every one of whom testifies that IBM possesses monopoly power such that its continuation in its present form represents a threat to the survival of the Republic. Break it up in order to save us all. And when the government gets finished, the defense calls the other half of the economics professors of the United States, each and every one of whom testifies that IBM is a sort of mom-and-pop store that did well. It doesn't threaten anybody. Just leave it alone, let it grow, and we'll all be okay. And as between the contending groups of experts, the judge, or sometimes the jury, has to decide. Now, reading just a little bit between the lines, but I think probably accurately, here's how Kaufman against Edelstein came to be. The government lawyers are sitting around one day, and they say, well, all right, so we've got our professors, they've got their professors, and it just doesn't amount to anything. One of the government lawyers said, you know, though, I just heard something that may be very useful. Sitting downtown in the Wall Street area are two men, not economics professors. One of them is a partner in one of the Big 8 accounting firms. The other is a partner in Arthur Little, the industrial engineers and consultants. Each of them has a graduate degree in business administration or economics. And each of them, as part of his work for the accounting firm or the consulting outfit, has studied the computer industry. And each of them is on record by way of memos and letters to clients of the firm as taking the position that IBM does have monopoly power and ought to be broken up, that it would work to the well-being of the computer industry. And you, whether you've tried antitrust cases or not, you know that if you're a government lawyer and you hear about these two guys, the blue saliva starts to run down your jaw. Here are two people who are not economics professors. They are not pointy-headed academics. What's more, they're probably registered Republicans, for God's sakes. They're on record as agreeing with your position in the lawsuit. Oh, boy, do you want them on the witness stand. So the government finds out who these guys are, and they really do exist. And the government goes to them, each of them separately, and says, will you come testify? All you have to do is come to court and tell the judge what you've already told the clients of your firms. And each of these guys says, no, I don't want to go. And the government says, what's the matter? Is it a question of money? Just name the... Well, we print it. We'll print some more for you. It doesn't matter. I say, no, it is not a question of money. It is a question of social style. We do not wish to be seen by the public at large and by our friends and customers to be supporting the government in this antitrust case. We don't want to testify. Leave us alone. So the government goes back. What are we going to do? This is not a case where you can't afford the experts. It's a case where the experts just don't want to come and testify. Somebody in the government council says, ah, they have no right to refuse to testify. We will serve them with a subpoena and tender a subway token. And then they have to come to court. And somebody else with a little more savvy says, no, no, no. It has been settled since the time of Henry II that you can't subpoena an expert. Dressing that up a little bit, an expert is regarded by the law traditionally as in a very different position from an ordinary witness. An ordinary witness, John Q. Bystander, who just happens to see the two cars collide, has an obligation of citizenship to come to court and tell the judge and jury what he saw, an obligation triggered simply by performing the ministerial act of serving him with a subpoena and tendering the witness fee, $2, $3, whatever it is in your area. But an expert, he owns his opinion. It is his private property. That's why he is free to sell it to you for $500, if you've got the $500. He's free to give it to you, if he's so inclined. But if he doesn't want to sell it to you, and if he doesn't want to give it to you, you cannot compel it of him. What do we do? Say the government lawyers. And the government lawyers said, well, there's nothing to do, so we might have nothing to lose. Let's serve the subpoena and tender the subway token and see what happens. So they send the deputy marshal out, and he serves each of these guys with an ordinary witness subpoena and gives them the subway token. That's the customary witness fee in the Southern District of New York. And now, again, reading between the lines. And here, I'm speaking not to the young lawyers in the room, but to the lawyers, a fair number of them, at least as old as I am, who, as I in my time have been, are partners in large law firms. And I hope I will be forgiven for revealing some of the trade union secrets. Each of these guys gets served with a subpoena. He doesn't know what a subpoena is. One of them is an accountant, the other is an industrial engineer. So they call up the senior partner of the Wall Street law firm that represents the accounting firm, or Arthur Little. And we all know the conversation. The fellow says, hey, Charlie, I just got served with a subpoena. What do we do? We have a problem. But I'm going to solve that problem for you. I'm setting up a task force right now. I'm the head of it. There will be 3 junior partners, 7 associates, 8 people to run the Lexus machine, and 3 messengers to go for coffee. And we're going to solve this problem for you. Fade out. Fade back in. $200,000 worth of clients' time later, each of those Wall Street law firms has come up with the solution to the problem. A motion to quash the subpoena. Yes, sir. And they march in before Judge Adelstein and they lay that motion on the bench in front of him and we say, we move to quash the subpoena. It has been settled since the days of Henry II that an expert may not be compelled. His opinion is his property and you can't make him give it to you. Well, it is no secret that Judge Adelstein in those days was deciding everything in favor of the government. Absolutely everything. So Judge Adelstein instantly said, the motion is denied, the subpoenas will be enforced. Ah, we were expecting this, say the Wall Street law firms. We take the elevator to the 17th floor. We now go to the Second Circuit. Since there's a little question as to whether this is an appealable order, what they did was file a notice of appeal in United States against IBM, but simultaneously ask the Second Circuit for a writ of mandamus, directing Judge Adelstein to quash those subpoenas. The writ of mandamus is styled Kaufman, he's one of the 2 prospective witnesses, against Adelstein, the judge. You want a mandamus. And that is what gives the case its name, Kaufman against Adelstein. Now, the Second Circuit decision is, of course, entitled to respect, as are the decisions of all courts. But I trust you will understand when I say that the fact that it's the Second Circuit perhaps gives it a special authority, the circuit that sort of has the highest professional standing with respect to commercial and civil litigation problems of this kind. And while all judges are entitled to our respect, the judges who decided Kaufman against Adelstein are really something special. The opinion is by Henry Friendly, one of the all-time great judges. There is a concurring opinion by Murray Gerfein, now deceased, but an equally great judge. And the third judge is also a terrific judge. So you've got 3 men to whom you would trust your life. And here they are addressing this problem. And really, it is astonishing to observe that what they do is affirm Judge Adelstein. They enforce the subpoenas. They say that those experts must testify. Now, this is my paraphrase, of course, but you can read the opinion when you get a moment. It's there in the materials. Judge Friendly points out that there are some limiting factors here, to be sure. First, they must testify, but not for a subway token. They will testify for a reasonable fee, and as Judge Friendly indicates, that's not the problem, we're told. If it does become a problem, the lawyers can come back to us. Otherwise, we leave it to them to work it out. And of course, that never was the problem, and the lawyers did work out the amount of the fee. Second, says Judge Friendly, this is just a little bit subtle, but perfectly clear, no one is requiring these experts to do any additional work besides come to court. That might raise 13th Amendment slavery problems. All that they are being required to do is come to court and testify to opinions already formulated as a result of their study of the computer industry and these letters and memos that they have written to clients of their firm. Again, in paraphrase, but I think it is a fair summary of what the opinion says. At this stage of our legal history, given the importance of expert witnesses, an importance we emphasized at the very outset 45 minutes ago, given the importance of experts, to say to experts today that you have a right to withhold your opinion simply because you regard it as your property is as much as to say you have a right to obstruct justice. If an ordinary witness, John Q. Bystander, has an obligation of citizenship to come to court and testify, so too should an expert, at least in these circumstances. Hence the subpoenas are enforced, and there you've got what is potentially the most significant decision of a good many years. Now, because the case has gone unnoted, because lawyers and judges tend to be unaware of it, because the law reviews, for example, have not picked it up, have not commented upon it, it's just lying there in the books, even though it's now 8 years. You really can't tell whether the case is going to turn out to be that important. Were we able to reconvene, let's say 20 years from now, then we would know. One possibility is that the case 20 years from now will be seen as a kind of signpost indicating the direction in which the law will develop. A direction along the lines of that in many circumstances, experts are compellable, as are ordinary witnesses. A lawyer can make an expert come to court and testify by way of footnote. If you're the lawyer who's compelled an expert, an unwilling expert, to come to court, you've got a forensic problem, don't you? You know, you've got a, you know, it's like disassembling a time bomb on the witness stand. He doesn't like you, he's unhappy, and he's going to do what he can to hurt you. But that's the kind of problem the law as a structure of doctrine cannot deal with. That's a practicing lawyer's problem. We're concerned only with the doctrine. And it may be that this case means that someday experts are compellable. You can make them come to court even though they are unwilling to do so. On the other hand, as a matter of professional candor, I've got to admit that 20, 30 years from now, it may turn out that this case will be one of that group of cases we're all familiar with, which, quote, must be limited to their facts, close quote. We all know those cases. They're never overruled, but it's always said that they must be limited to their facts. That is to say, this case would be good authority only the next time the government sues to break up IBM, and a guy named Kaufman is unwilling to testify as an expert, and the judge presiding is named Edelstein. Otherwise, you must not rely upon it. Well, if we do reconvene in 20 or 30 years, we'll see where we stand. But for now, why, we've got to move along. So much, not because that's all there is to say, but really because that's all the time will allow for what you might think of as the pretrial phases of it. Identifying an issue, identifying an expert, and then getting the expert to come to court. Let us turn now to what happens in court. I'm deliberately not discussing discovery with respect to experts because I think if you have a pretty good sense of what happens in court, the discovery part of it is almost presupposed or implicit. In order that I be less than usually confusing, I tell you that we will discuss direct examination of experts first, because that comes first. And after we discuss direct, we'll talk about the cross-examination of experts, and then finally we'll talk about some ideas I have on how most effectively to argue expert witness credibility to a jury. So we're now in court, and we undertake the direct examination. Everything that I have to say, ladies and gentlemen, is applicable to any kind of witness on any kind of issue in any kind of case. Of necessity, I will need examples as we go along, and for the most part, my examples will be drawn from medicine, because at least in my experience, doctors are the most frequently encountered expert witnesses in litigation. Personal injury, family litigation, criminal litigation, whatever. It strikes me that with respect to the direct examination of an expert, there are five principal issues of evidence or trial technique that a lawyer must have absolutely at his or her fingertips. I mean, you cannot begin to function in a case involving experts unless you know exactly what the lay of the land is on these five issues. So let me talk about them in turn, and I'll try to remember to number them so that your notes coincide with what you remember me saying, and in any event, you have the printed outline in front of you. Okay, first issue. Everybody who's ever tried a case involving experts knows this. Probably every lawyer knows it, whether or not he or she has ever tried a case. The first thing you do on the direct examination of an expert is qualify the expert. And that's kind of a trial lawyer's piece of shop talk, qualify the expert. If you want to spell it out in a formal sentence, the proponent must persuade the judge at the very beginning that this witness is entitled to the benefit of the expert witness exception to the non-opinion rule. Now, that's a lot of gobbledygook for some stuff that everybody knows, but let me take a moment to remind you of it. This is the doctrinal setting of the beginning of the direct examination of every expert. This is the context against which you start out. Witnesses generally may not testify to opinions. They may only testify to sense perceptions, what they saw, smelled, heard, touched, or tasted. That is generally called the opinion rule. I prefer to call it the non-opinion rule because that's what it is. There are exceptions to the non-opinion rule. The one that concerns us here is the exception for experts, because the expert's opinion in a New York type state is necessary to the jury. In a federal state, will help the jury. The opinion is admissible. The expert may testify to an opinion even though the rule normally forbids them. So you say that he's taking advantage of the expert witness exception to the non-opinion rule. Who decides that he's entitled to take advantage of that exception? His Honor, the judge. On what basis? And this is settled in the law of evidence. It sometimes comes as a little surprise, but this is all that's involved. If this proposed expert knows more than the man or woman in the street, he is an expert for these purposes, and the judge will rule that he may give his opinion under the expert witness exception to the non-opinion rule. In short, it doesn't take much to be an expert in the eyes of the law. It takes only enough to persuade the judge that he knows more than the man in the street.